was tired of thinking and tired of the desert, tired of forcing meaning and pretending to be tough on this stupid road. I didn't want to voice my despair. I thought it would discourage Weston. But I also felt so weak and alone in my loss of wonder and desire for the trip. "Dude, this has been hard for me," I finally confessed to Weston the night before we got to La Paz. We had camped for the night in a dusty riverbed, and as we were drifting to sleep, with the promise of a city the next day and some kind of escape, I told the truth. "I've been trying to stay positive, but damn, I'm ready for La Paz, for a city, for that ferry, and to get off this peninsula." "Shit, I am so glad you've hated it too. I want tropical beaches and warm water, any water. I can't drink one more Coca-Cola or eat one more cracker and salami. I'm so fucking over it. Dude, I thought you were so okay with all this." "Fuck no, I've hated this hell since I got sick in Guerrero Negro." "Really? Me too," he said, feeling sudden companionship. "I didn't want to say anything because I thought it would bum you out or chance the energy. I wanted to be positive." "Me too," I said. "I feel like we're so lucky to be on this trip, and people wish they were doing it and not stuck at a desk job. But damn, the adventure wears off, doesn't it? I mean, I'm not ready to quit right now or anything, but it feels good to admit it isn't one long string of euphoria." "Fuck, it feels good to admit that," Weston said in the darkness of his hammock. "Let's drink all the beer in La Paz, live it up for a minute, and catch the ferry out of this shitbox of desert hell." We both laughed hard at the release of being allowed to hate the adventure we were on. The next day, we cycled into La Paz and celebrated the miracle of civilization. We stayed with a Christian woman named Lucinda that we found on Warm Showers. She was excited to share Jesus and her church with us. We slept on the couch in her small house. Her hot shower and stocked refrigerator and soft voice felt so welcoming. We went to a movie theater, an IMAX even, and downed enough popcorn and soda to make us nearly puke. We saw the movie Gravity and felt that we'd been transported to the future. The air-conditioned theater, the soft seats, the special effects. I felt very close to Weston, having survived the desert, sleeping by fires and hunting water and relishing cold Coca-Colas and the conversations with locals, both strange and sweet. We were comrades, brothers already. While in La Paz, homesick but encouraged, contemplating how I was going to stay sane for the next year on this bike trip, my friend Adam emailed, "A crew of homies is going surfing in Nexpa, Mexico. Is that on your way? It's tropical and tiny and perfect. You'll love it. Come hang with us. November 6th. I checked the map. Nexpa was indeed on our course. We'd ferry from La Paz, near the tip of Baja, to the mainland, to a city called Mazatlan. Then we'd head south to Puerto Vallarta. Then, down below that, was Nexpa. To get there by November 6th would require a push, but to see our friends would be worth it. When I ran the idea by Weston, he was ecstatic, so I told Adam that we'd meet them there, no matter what it took. We stayed a couple more nights in La Paz, relishing the creature comforts, laughing and getting drunk, then bought tickets for the overnight ferry to Mazatlan and the mainland. It was a 13-hour crossing. We couldn't afford the private cabins, so we had to sleep on the deck of the ship. There were probably 100 people, maybe more, bodies in every corner hiding from the cold and wet wind. Weston met an eccentric old white man who had left the United States because he thought it was too corrupt. They started swapping conspiracy theories. The guy told us he had a private cabin with 3 empty beds, and said we could sleep in his room. I crawled into the top bunk and tried to sleep while the old man kept telling Weston about contrails and the falsification of the moon landing and Obama's secret mission to buy Cuba. Weston was endlessly fascinated. I was happy to be off the deck of the boat. I fell asleep as they were discussing the fact that fossil fuel comes from dead dinosaurs and how it is impossible that there were that many dead dinosaurs to provide enough oil for the world, and that therefore petroleum was a chemical made up by the Russians to control the world. Chapter 7. Cartels and Coconuts. 11,834 miles to go. Crossing that slip of ocean was like sliding down a wormhole to another kind of earth. Immediately, the mountains of Mexico turned from dust brown to jungle green. The rivers here swelled with muddy water, and I had never been so happy to see chubby tourists and traffic. Mazatlan is a tourist destination, with hotels and restaurants lining the beach, bicycles for rent, families splashing in the waves, and everywhere signs for beer and tacos and happy hours and margaritas. It felt familiar, like Florida. Weston got high and we rode our bikes in the humid, hot night air without shirts on. True to form, Weston's tire popped on the boardwalk and we had to fix it and it took forever. So we found a shitty hostel down the road and slept in a bunk room full of snorers. Still, we were incapable of being frustrated, so inflated with joy that we floated like parade animals over a marching band. The next day, under a hot, wet sun, we started south to Puerto Vallarta. The city quickly turned into coastal farms and fields. We hadn't ridden in humidity yet, and sweat poured from our bodies. My helmet filled with sweat that dripped in my eyes. Over the next few days, farms gave way to tree-covered mountains, and now it looked like Hawaii. In Puerto Vallarta, the scene changed to expensive boat docks and condos and high-rises. We stayed at a hostel and walked around town. Halloween was in the air. We got drinks with strangers, and people were in elaborate costumes. And lots of gay guys were out in Speedos and boas. "Jed, you might just get some tonight," Weston said. "I don't think so. I am not in a Speedo, nor do I intend to be. I look like a scrawny hippie rat from this bike trip. I ain't getting no buff beach boy," I said, deflecting. "Well, you're not with that attitude," Weston said. We had so much fun in Puerto Vallarta that we stayed for several days. We should have left, but next boat was several days right away, and we had to get there by the second. But we met some French girls, and Weston was trying to kiss one, and we loved the beach, and our hostel was cheap. The town had great restaurants, narrow cobblestone streets, and steep mountains all around. I read on the beach, watched a parade, drank good coffee, and bought coconuts from street vendors for a dollar. We knew we were staying too long, but we wanted to have fun anyway. We knew it would mean hitchhiking south. We didn't care. Fuck expectations. Early on the second, we packed up our things and biked out of town. We figured if we could get on the southern highway, some truck or farmer might take us the rest of the way. At a promising spot, we turned our bikes upside down and I managed to find a piece of cardboard to make a sign. "Nexpa," I added a smiley face. No ride materialized. Every truck that came around the corner only sped on by. After several miserable hours of standing in the sun, a local bus stopped, and the driver made an offer we couldn't refuse. It took the rest of the day to reach Nexpa. Turns out we had badly miscalculated. We learned the hard way that 300 miles by bus on a narrow, winding road in Latin America is likely to take a lifetime. We drove through forested hills and shoulder-high grass along the road. Cows stood almost invisible in the fields, eating their fill. At dusk, when the bus finally pulled into Nexpa, we felt like cheaters, but we didn't care. Who were we cheating? We made the rules. Nexpa is just a romantic blip on the coast where the waves are perfect and a lazy river pours into the Pacific. Almost no internet, no supermarkets, no stores. We showed up to the one-street town and went looking for our friends. They'd mentioned that they were at the main hostel right by the beach. As we walked our bikes down the little street, we saw hammocks and people on the balcony of the only obvious hostel, and I heard English, and then I heard Adam's voice. We ditched our bikes without locking them and ran up the rickety stairs. It was a riot of cheers and hugs and holy shit you found us and get these men some beers. I felt like a soldier coming home from war. We laughed uncontrollably and hugged and touched their faces and made foolish jokes about getting shit-faced and partying just to laugh more. The hostel was a series of beach huts and shacks owned by a British woman named Susan who'd married a Mexican man and was raising her kids in this outpost of paradise. The beach curved around a crescent bay to the mouth of a river, where the flow of fresh water had pushed sand into a bar that made for excellent surfing waves. Huts topped with thatched roofs studded the sand, and the air was warm and pleasant. We surfed and got sunburned and drank beers and befriended the owner of the only bar on the beach. His name was Stuart, and he spoke English with an American accent. I asked him his story. Stuart told us he was born in Mexico, but had raised a family in Florida until some bullshit happened between him and his wife. She called the police and claimed he hit her and messed her up, and he got deported. He said she was a crazy bitch, and that he just wants to see his kids, and that he's not a bad guy. "It's a wild thing to think," he said. "You're building a whole life in the U.S. with a wife and American-born kids, and then you get sent to live in Mexico again." I had never really lived in Mexico, so I opened this bar. It's pretty cool. But I meet a lot of American surfers, and it makes me want to get back to the U.S. It's pretty fucked up. As he talked, I would drift between good cheer and observation. This often happens to me when I'm listening to someone tell a story they've rehearsed 100 times with 100 different visitors. Their face is not astonished by their own words. They're not reading your face as they go to tell if their sentences are landing. They're bored at the injustice of having to make their case again and again to a deaf universe. The days drifted by with big beers and big waves and sitting in the back of rented trucks and beat up local trucks as we hunted not just remote beaches, but beaches that seemed to be lost to humanity. I half expected a velociraptor to stalk me as I napped under the palm trees. Then, on the morning of November 4th, the town started scrambling around, gossip traveling with lightning speed. All roads in every direction had been blockaded. The military was staging an overthrow of the Knights Templar, the main cartel here in the state of Michoacán. An hour down the coast in Lázaro Cárdenas, the largest town on this part of the coast, the Knights Templar had taken control of the port for the past few years. They'd slowly bribed and muscled their way into controlling trade in and out. Component chemicals for methamphetamine production came into the port from Asia, and then from there they could make the meth in the nearby jungles, then put it right on trains and trucks bound for the United States. They'd made millions as a result. The military was retaking the port and pushing the Knights Templar into the jungle and up the coast, back toward us. We had no idea what was going on, only that the people of Nexpa seemed to be stressed. "The mafia is pissed," they told us. "They run this state." The last time the Knights Templar fought the military, Nexpa was stranded without food or water for 2 months. Every kid and grandma comes out to the street with their guns. Black military helicopters buzzed overhead all day. Humvees loaded down with local vigilantes, supported by the military, roared past the surf shacks. We couldn't even get to the supermarket 2 miles down the road. Shaken up, we went to Stuart's bar to drink and dull our nerves and listen to the gossip. He explained that the Knights Templar got their name from medieval warriors who protected Christian pilgrims during the Crusades. They'd become the de facto government in Michoacán. They patrolled the state's steep forests and chaotic network of dirt roads in lifted four-wheel drive trucks. They moved like ghosts, nowhere and everywhere. Recently, they had been trying to diversify their income. They'd made a fortune selling meth to the U.S. and had seized iron ore mines in Michoacan to sell the mineral to hungry Chinese companies. They were also illegally selling rare Mexican timber to the Chinese, Stewart said. They'd bribed and conned their way into control of the massive industrial port in Lázaro Cárdenas, which had a direct line to China and was poised to become the biggest Pacific port outside of Los Angeles. In retaliation, the military had been secretly preparing an attack. Today was the day. Today they choked every road in the state. When men entered the bar, "You can always tell cartel boys," Stewart whispered. "They show up in lifted trucks and carry huge walkie-talkies." The men couldn't have been older than 19, and it was clear that the far corner table was theirs and always theirs. They seemed calm and wound up at the same time, like pit bulls. For an hour, the cartel boys set the tone of the room, ordering beers and talking among themselves, watching football on the television and occasionally mumbling into their walkie-talkies. At one point, one of the teams scored and they were visibly pleased. They looked over at us, the nervous gringos at the bar, pretending to be oblivious to their presence, and raised their glasses in muted cheers. We cheersed back. They smiled, downed the last gulps, and walked out. Stories of life in cartel country kept flowing with the beer. Susan, the British surf goddess who owned the hostel shack we were renting, talked about a Texas family that had come down in their brand new white F-150 truck. They entered Michoacan, and within the hour, cartel boys and jeeps had pulled them over at gunpoint. The boys politely escorted the startled Texans out of their truck, said gracias for the donation, and left them on the side of the road. "You have to drive a beat-up piece-of-shit car," Susan explained, "and you'll be left perfectly alone. Show up in an all-wheel drive anything, and it'll be gone in a week." She had built a life on this beach, minding her own business, and making it a point to own nothing the cartels could want. We spent the next few days at the bar, thirsty for news. In this place, the internet, where it even existed, offered no answers or updates. We only had word of mouth. The sense of being stranded in paradise was kind of nice. Susan kept ensuring us that everything was fine, that the cartels would never bother tourists. But there was a forced confidence in her words. We all knew that drunk, money-hungry teenagers with guns could lead to unfortunate events. Our buddies from California stayed up through the night debating whether or not to tell their girlfriends and wives about the roadblocks. And by roadblocks, I mean the cartel. In the United States, the dominant story about Mexico is cartel violence. I had told my mom that reports were overblown, that Mexico was wonderful, that she was xenophobic. But here I was, surrounded by teenagers with guns and Humvees and military helicopters. My friends were deciding not to tell their wives. I was not going to tell my mother. I couldn't give up on my global optimism. I've always believed that the world is far friendlier than it is not, far more loving than hateful. Fear is like a thorn in your foot. It may be proportionally small in relation to the body, but it hurts and demands attention and everything halts until the thorn gets pulled. But damn it, I felt stupid, feigning my optimism here in Nexpa, playing it cool, wondering if I'd be shot by accident or on purpose. There is truth in a mother's worry. There is also exaggeration and unfairness. If I die, she wins, I thought. If I live, I win. The truth is, violence is the exception, not the rule, in almost all places on this planet. There's a saying in journalism, if it bleeds, it leads. Humanity fixates on violence. We're fascinated by its abnormality. We want to understand it and learn how to avoid it. But the truth lies somewhere in between blood and peace. Most of us will move through life without experiencing the abnormalities of violence. But that does not mean those abnormalities don't exist. It was strange, watching the waves crash, feeling the cold breeze on our faces. Nothing had changed, except the news and the goings-on of humans. A coup was underway, and paradise didn't seem to notice. We went surfing, my California buddies talking nonstop about their wives and girlfriends. "Melissa did not want me to come," one guy said. "But she's always worried about nothing. Fuck." Now that the roadblocks had sprung up and the locals were nervous, they seemed shaken, perhaps more shaken by proving their ladies right than by the possibility of injury. To hear them talk, this wrongness would come at a great cost down the road. "I told you so" is a weapon that can be deployed for years. Weston and I listened as our friends anxiously calculated how to get home, but we knew we weren't going anywhere. They heard the government was letting people through the roadblocks to the airport, so they decided to hop in the rental car and chance it. We woke up early to say goodbye. They were leaving just a day early from their scheduled trip, but the debates and planning of escape routes consumed so many hours the day before, it felt like we had all been stranded and trapped in the tiny town for weeks. Later in the morning, Susan gave us stand-up paddle boards, and her 13-year-old daughter took us out on the river. As we slid them into the warm water, she warned us against paddling across the river's wide mouth, because that's where the crocodiles like to hang out. We said okay and laughed. Teenagers with guns, now crocs. But as the three of us paddled upstream, we weren't thinking of war. Tall palm trees and thick jungle leaned out over the water, and I watched the muddy banks for logs that could be crocodiles. Paddling was easy in the lazy current. In the distance, we saw cliffs covered in vines and flowers. Birds spooked and flew from the trees. Weston paddled alongside me, and Susan's daughter slid ahead of us as if not paddling at all. We got to talking about explorers and Indiana Jones and Steven Spielberg and movies from the 80s. Weston said, "Can I tell you something that will make you hate me?" I said, "Of course, I already hate you." "There are two things I don't like, and every time I say these things, people hate me afterwards." "This is a safe place. On this river, we can speak truth without judgment," I said. "Okay, well here we go. I don't like Star Wars, and I think I hate the Beatles." He paddled forward and didn't look at me. He grinned at this scandal. "What?" I shouted. "You have got to be kidding me, Star Wars? How can you be a stable human being without loving Star Wars? Do you hate sunsets, too? What about food? Do you hate food?" I shouted. "See, I told you," he said, laughing. "This river is not a safe place. I've made a huge mistake." For an exercise in empathy, I tried to argue his point of view. Okay, I mean, the Beatles, I don't love some of their songs," I said. "And I must admit, I get annoyed when music snobs demand I like something because it was groundbreaking. But the Beatles' sound changed so many times, there has to be some song of theirs you like. Like Eleanor Rigby, come on, you have to love that song." "I'm not sure I know it," Weston said. "Okay, thank God, there's hope," I said. It's remarkable how normal moments live on in the middle of chaos and tragedy. People still play chess and drink tea in the middle of war. New inside jokes are born at funerals. Stranded in Nexpa, I saw the locals laughing over beers, making jokes about the military, about the cartels, about resorting to powdered milk the last time this happened. Human beings have little capacity for sustained horror. I think our minds need to play to survive. Permanently serious people always look so tired, maybe because they are fighting an emotional battle that eats the body alive. To laugh and play while the bombs drop is one way to survive a war, even to win it. As we paddled up the river, we came to the big bridge on the coastal highway. It loomed over us tall and cracked. We heard a loud engine and looked up as a Humvee boomed down from the bridge. We paused for a minute to make eye contact and acknowledge the wildness of what was happening around us. Weston broke our silence. Do you think me hating Star Wars is worse than being the leader of a cartel? Absolutely. Beyond the bridge, we came upon a huddle of crocs floating in the middle of the river. In a tight-chested instant, we turned around and paddled furiously, laughing and feeling exposed on the boards. Once downriver, we dragged the boards up onto the grass to watch Susan's daughter shimmy like a spider up a tree to knock down some coconuts with her machete. The giant rusted knife looked half as long as she was tall. Back on the ground, she slashed off the tops of the coconuts, revealing the milky meat inside, tender and delicious. The next day, Humvees buzzed across the bridge and kicked up dust, and black helicopters patrolled the beaches. I lay in the hammock. I did push-ups. I sliced more coconuts. I found a stack of old National Geographics in Susan's hostel. One of them, from 1986, had a story about Leo Tolstoy, about his hometown in Russia, about the man behind the legend. I grabbed it and walked out to the river. I sat against a palm tree facing upriver, where I could see the bridge and the Humvees and the mountains. Behind me, I could hear the waves of the ocean. I read that when Tolstoy was young, he wrote in his journal, "I am 24 years old, and I have still done nothing. I am sure it's not for nothing that I have been struggling with all my doubts and passions for the past 8 years. But what am I destined for? Only time will tell." I was 30 years old reading this, sitting by a river in Mexico, wondering what I had done with my life. I knew it wasn't for nothing that I'd been struggling with all my doubts and passions for the past 20 years. I had dipped so deeply and completely into my faith, into my love of God, or who I made God to be, and what the people around me said he must think about everything. I knew it was not for nothing, but what, I didn't know. I just knew it was somewhere in me, and I needed travel to shake it out. I needed to see different things to remind me what I was, in contrast to what I already knew, to see clearly what I had become. Days passed trapped on that riverbank beside that beach, with nowhere to possibly go, all tangled up in my head. We lounged and played in paradise and spent many hours at the bar. To Weston's delight, Stewart would always walk out and hand us free joints. Stewart had news on the cartel war, too. He explained that the Knights Templar were losing their fight with the military and getting pushed into the jungle. But the rule of law wouldn't follow in their wake. Stewart's uncle was high up in another cartel. I think it was called La Familia, based in Morelia, Michoacán's capital city. One that had more members and sway with the government. Once this fight was done, they would move into the region and pick up where their predecessors left off. 10 days in, we woke to the new normal of coffee and toast and waiting for any news of the fighting. Susan was not in the hostel when we got up. As we were making the coffee, she ran in, excited. "It's over! The military pushed the mafia out last night, and they retreated. The roadblocks came down this morning." The weight of the air suddenly lifted. The beach town was no longer a prison. We were, it seemed, free. Nothing around me had changed. The river flowed just as it had minutes ago. The waves were still pumping. The coconuts grew in silence just the same. But the whole world looked different. Our internment camp had morphed back into a beach town. We spent a final day with Susan in Nexpa. It was a vacation again, but with our new freedom, we felt the time we'd lost. We should have been in Morelia by now. Susan had whetted our appetites for the colonial beauty of the city, the cobblestone streets, the cathedrals. But she wasn't confident that the cartel nonsense was over, so she insisted on driving us south to Lázaro Cárdenas. That way, we'd be through the epicenter of the fighting and on the highway that led up the mountains to Morelia. We gratefully accepted. She dropped us by the highway, and we hugged, and she waved as we cycled away. We made it one day up the mountain, slept terribly in a bug-infested grove of trees, and early the next day, Weston's wheel broke. After trying for 3 hours to get a truck to rescue us, we asked a passerby with a phone to let us make a call. I had written down Susan's number, thank God, and we called her. She seemed relieved to hear from us, as if she hoped we'd call, to check in or to need her again. I don't like driving the truck up in the mountains because the mafia loves to steal trucks, she said. But this is Ricardo's truck. I hope it gets stolen. He deserves to have his truck fucking stolen. Here I come. To get out of the sun, we waited under a bridge until she pulled up honking and waving and laughing. We were sweaty and so happy to see her. She reiterated her fear of driving, so Weston drove. We threw our bikes in the back and traveled from sea level to over 6,000 feet, from hills covered in jungle and palm trees to farmland, to pine trees, to cooler air. The humidity quickly dropped as we drove higher. As I sat in the truck and watched the land whiz by, I felt how my trip was changing. I was having fun, and I wasn't. This wasn't a weekend camping trip. There would be no quick return. My bed wasn't waiting for me. Not long ago, I was thinking how brave I was to go on this trip and do this difficult thing. I reveled in people's astonishment. Now their astonishment made sense. They knew something I hadn't. What was I doing here? But I held this feeling of dread in one hand. The other hand was holding love. Love for Mexico, for the land and the ocean, for the freedom of seeing new things and not knowing what was next. Have you ever felt two things at once, two opposite things? Farms became little villages, became the outskirts of Morelia. Fields gave way to a tightly packed Spanish colonial grid, with cobblestone streets and walls and the spires of cathedrals reaching high above the grid. Morelia looked more like the photos I'd seen of Spain than what I knew of Mexico. Susan was going to stay with a friend in town, so she dropped us at our hostel. Later, we met up at the cathedral to find dinner. As we walked up, a full symphony was playing in the square, and there was a fireworks show at the entrance to the cathedral, set to shoot off as the orchestra crescendoed. It was all part of a music festival taking place in town. Morelia felt every bit as cosmopolitan and savvy as an artist's town in Germany or Park City, Utah. We couldn't believe the contrast here to the feeling of lawlessness on the coast. The streets of Morelia were stone, the buildings European. I stood, frozen, in front of the two giant cathedral bell towers as the orchestra played. Women in big Victorian dresses, fully in costume, waltzed around in front of the violinists. Thousands of people milled about and were mostly quiet to respect the musicians. Weston and I felt safe again. For the next 2 days, we explored Morelia by eating at cafes and walking the streets. Thanks to the music festival, parades of musicians from all over the world shocked us at every turn. Bagpipes from Scotland, jazz, tubas, and cellos. Walking in clumps, playing their music over flower petals strewn in the streets. Morelia had a well-stocked bike shop and an oily mechanic to fix Weston's bike. We bought lots of new tubes. I had my bike checked out and cleaned and lubed. When both were shiny and ready to roll, we mapped our route to Mexico City. The next day, we rode out of Morelia. The town ended abruptly, from thick Spanish stone to rolling hills and farms. Then, as quick as a page turn, we were winding up into the Green Mountains. It was gasp-worthy beautiful. The air was crisp, the sky sunny and blue, the world inviting. The trees were tall and the cows by the side of the road were fat and pleasant. We rode for several days. We started seeing monarch butterflies, lots of them, on weeds, by the road and in the air. We camped in abandoned barns and thick forests. We took a shower in a waterfall. The Baja Desert had worn me down. Mainland Mexico was showing me something new. This was the Altiplano, the giant spine of Mexico, floating more than 5,000 feet above sea level, cooling the air, reducing humidity, and making the world as pleasant as paradise. A natural kindness. 3 days into the ride, the sky changed. It was full of specks. Birds too high to make out? Millions. Pepper raining across the sky. What is that? Weston asked. I don't know. I stared into the sky as we stood by the side of the road, squinting up. Jed, look, Weston said, pointing to a bush. It had several monarch butterflies on it. Dude, they're butterflies. The great monarch butterfly migration was underway just as we approached the town of Zitácuaro. A local told us that we were near the forest where they arrive every fall by the millions and millions. We ditched our bikes at a cheap motel and took a bus to the forest. The mountains here were covered in evergreen trees. The air was chilly and garnished in mist. We booked a horseback ride into the forest. Our guide took us over a ridge and down into a gully where we saw that the trees looked strange, as if they were dipped in chocolate and dripping. Can you tell us why they're here? Weston asked. Sure, he said with a proud smile. I remember his English being excellent. He'd done this tour many times before. Monarch butterflies born in the fall are different than all the other monarchs. They are a super generation. They can live up to 8 months as they travel from Canada all the way down to our forest. Then, after waiting out winter here, they'll head up to warmer places like Louisiana and breed. Their children will live for only 6 weeks. It can take 5 generations of their children, who live so much shorter lives, to get back to Canada. Then, those born at the beginning of fall, they become the super ones again. Then those ones begin the great journey. They can fly from Michigan all the way here to Zitácuaro. As we got closer, we saw that every single inch of each tree was covered in butterflies. Look up, our guide said, and in the holes of blue sky between the trees, we saw a blizzard of butterflies. This is early, and more butterflies will come. But now too many butterflies don't come back. 5 years ago, we had 10 times more. The monarch too? I thought of the bees and what it must mean, we humans ruining everything. We don't have any way to process how everything we do touches everything else. It is probably climate change, the guide said, or technology, the cell phones. Something that people are doing is confusing them or causing them to die. It is very sad. We do not care for the beautiful things of this world. His voice was heavy and pensive as he worried out loud about the future of this forest and his region's claim to fame. We returned to our bikes, thrilled at the majesty of the butterflies and thrown by the confusing science of their decline. When we got back to our motel, a parade was noisily clanging down Zitácuaro's main street. So many parades. Cycling through the mountains of central Mexico, we would camp and find tiny hotels for less than $10 a night. On one rainy night in the woods, we used our tarps and hammock string to make a simple A-frame ground tent. It got very cold up in the mountains at night, so we hoped we could make a tent to stay dry and warm side by side. We were at close to 9,000 feet. It rained, and we got wet, but not soaked. As I was falling asleep on my back, something fell onto my closed eye. I reached up and felt a squirming, fuzzy creature. I flicked it off and found my phone for some light. My eye was already on fire, as were my fingers. Weston heard me scream, "Damn it!" and sat up. "What?" he asked. "Something stung the shit out of my eye." The flashlight revealed a fuzzy brown caterpillar crawling on my sleeping bag. Apparently, its fuzz was a swarm of stinging needles, and it had fallen right onto my eyelid. I fell asleep with my hand pressing on my eye, wondering if I'd been poisoned and doomed to blindness. I woke up the next day, soggy and okay, but determined to sleep in hotels for a few days. We passed Christmas tree farms and white tarp greenhouses of poinsettias. We saw vendors selling stick sculptures with Santa Clauses and reindeer shaped from bundled sticks and vines. It was mid-November, and the Christmas decorations made me feel happy. If they've got the Christmas decorations out, that means it's coming, and I'll go home for the holidays and get a bit of a break. A few days later, the road dropped out of the mountains and into Toluca, a big town west of Mexico City. We found a family to stay with on warm showers and met a group of three brothers. They took us to dinner and practiced their impeccable English. They loved pop punk music and Quentin Tarantino movies. They said they were perfecting their English through watching television and movies. They said that this would get them good jobs in the hotel industry. They said we shouldn't bike from their house into Mexico City because it is too crowded and only freeways. We said warm goodbyes and cycled to the edge of town. From there, we hitchhiked in the bed of a truck into Mexico City. I began to sense the scale of Mexico City, more sprawling and populous by far than New York City. But what did it look like? I couldn't picture a skyline or even a building. I conjured up the grimy streets from Man on Fire, the Denzel Washington movie with child kidnapping and car chases racing through the city. It is strange to know a place's name so well, to know something about it, and to have almost no image of it in your mind. The Mexican Altiplano had changed my tune about this country. The baking misery of Baja was a memory. This was a paradise. As an American, my assumptions about Mexico were formed in ignorance. I assumed the country was a dry, dusty desert populated by cacti and big hats and U-shaped horses and sun-baked clay homes. And then maybe Cancun, jungles, white sand, and embarrassing tourist traps. It never crossed my mind that the center of the country could possibly look different or have its own benefits. I didn't think about it. I had just filled in the blanks with drug cartels and heads in bags. And yes, I had been stranded by a cartel, sure, but somehow I couldn't agree with my mom. Take, for example, the chain of towns called Pueblos Mágicos, one-time colonial settlements that run through the mountains of central Mexico and elsewhere. Each town is Spanish by design, built to remind the colonists of their homeland and paid for by the king's gold, much of it heisted from the Aztecs and Mayas. At the center of each town is a massive cathedral and square. These beautiful relics, still very much alive and bustling with life, are far older than anything in the United States. They feel so completely European that their proximity to the United States comes as a shock. You look up at one of those buildings, and some subconscious association between European architecture and distance causes your mind to assume jet lag and time zone adjustments. But all of these towns are in the same time zones as the United States. When I walked the streets of Morelia, I thought of how absurd it was that no one I know had ever been there. In Toluca, I called my mom. I told her that my extended stay in Nexpa was simply a desire to soak up the sun. Now that I was safe and far from the coast, the cartel felt fake. I gloated to her about the butterflies, the cathedrals, the music festival, the colors and flowers, the constant parades, the food. It was as if Mexico had tortured me with that desert, testing me to see if I was worthy. Now she was showing me all her riches. I was falling in love with a country I'd never really considered. Sometimes love sneaks up on you, doesn't it? But then, perhaps we'd only been lucky. Chapter 8. The Cathedral Sits on the Temple. Mexico City. 10,740 miles to go. Mexico City is a beast, the second largest city in the world, spreading out in every direction. Not too many skyscrapers, just apartment buildings and homes and flat rooftops and satellites sticking out of windows and clothes on lines and honking cars. Originally, the city was the capital of the Aztec Empire. and the city's very existence is a testament to Aztec genius. This high-elevation valley had been a shallow lake, but the Aztecs made their own land by packing mud and grass to create ever-expanding islands. When the Spanish conquistadors showed up in the 1500s, they set out to erase that empire. Today, ancient trade routes lie buried under freeways. The massive cathedral at the city's center rises on the foundation of the destroyed temple and pyramids beneath it. In some kind of karmic justice, the cathedral leans right, sinking further into the mud year after year. I thought about how the church of my youth had built a cathedral on top of me, on top of my sexuality, burying my desires, trying to erase an insurrection. I knew that the gospel was true, and therefore it was worth spreading it at any cost, right? For the saving of my soul, for the saving of the Aztecs, right? We got our bikes out of the truck right outside the giant plaza in front of the massive cathedral. Its proper name is the Metropolitan Cathedral of the Assumption of the Most Blessed Virgin Mary into heaven. Whoa. It's the largest cathedral in the Americas. We gawked at it for a few minutes, but quickly strapped our things back on our bikes. We walked over to a park bench and sat down. We had to bike to some suburb to meet our host, and I needed to study the map. City biking. Dear God. We had found a girl on Instagram who offered to host us. She had messaged me. If you need a place to crash in southern Mexico City in the area of Coyoacán, you will love, as we say in Mexico, my house is your house. Also, I can show the city or whatever you need in their days in the city. Good life forever, Beatrice. She sounded great. We had no idea who she was, of course, but when we checked her photos on Instagram and tags to see if she had friends, if she had weird tastes or any red flags, she seemed normal enough. She liked coffee shops and getting drinks with friends and the occasional museum. Instagram stalking felt oddly trustworthy. Studying how people represented themselves said a lot about who they were. At least, that was our hope. Looking at my map, I had forgotten to click the button for turn-by-turn directions. Google Maps could show me the streets, but without Wi-Fi, it couldn't show me the route. Shit. I checked for open Wi-Fi. DF Wi-Fi gratis came up immediately. I clicked it. There were some directions in Spanish I didn't understand, but a box to check. I checked it. Then I had Wi-Fi. Full bars. The entire plaza had free Wi-Fi. Los Angeles had nothing like this. Weston had lost his phone again. I think I left it in the truck, he said casually. Classic. So I navigated for us, which was normal. I stuck my phone in the little clip between my handlebars and let the map tell me where to go through a maze of turns. This would be the most confusing navigation I'd done. Usually, we were on country roads or two-lane highways in the middle of nowhere. This route was a mess. Turn after turn and roundabouts and alleys. While I scrolled around the map and cursed under my breath, Weston rolled a joint and took a couple of puffs. He was looking around and soaking up the plaza. I was sweating over my phone. The sun was out and sharp and hot. At 7,300 feet, the elevation of Mexico City made the sun feel closer. We started biking with Weston right behind me. Cars were everywhere, honking, speeding, mirrors whizzing by and clipping my panniers. Meanwhile, Weston was taking puffs on his joint and riding gleefully, zigzagging and taking his time. Many of the intersections were clotted and chaotic. I'd pump as quickly as I could through them, only to stop on the other side and see him looking in the other direction. I'd call his name, and he'd see me and grin and take his time to cross. Sorry, man. I'm coming. This place is awesome. At a few of the intersections, we had to carry our bikes over one of the caged-in walkways above the street. The act of lifting my bike with all its gear up the stairs, one step at a time, felt like moving a refrigerator, but a bony, sharp, floppy refrigerator that rolls out of your grip and tears at your shins. In 30 minutes, we'd made it about halfway to Beatrice's. Then I lost Weston. I had crossed a bridge and then an on-ramp and stopped on the other side. Weston was a bit behind me, but in clear view. He was leisurely crossing the bridge, humming and bopping his head. He wasn't looking at me or anything really, just grinning and bopping. As he was about to cross the on-ramp, maybe 20 feet from me, he veered right, following the natural curve of the road. I shouted his name. I shouted again. He didn't look up at all. He was vibing to unheard music without a care in the world. He merged onto the freeway and disappeared under a bridge and into the flow of 65-mile-per-hour traffic. I stopped yelling his name. I stood there with my mouth wide open. Surely Weston would get instantly struck and killed. He didn't know where he was going. He didn't have a phone. My phone didn't work to make a call in Mexico. Anyway, who would I call? Crossing back to the bridge, I looked down onto the freeway. He was gone. How the hell would we find each other? But Weston is scrappy. He's fine, right? He doesn't know where we're headed, but he'll know to find a computer somewhere and email me or Facebook message me. He's not an idiot. Okay, I'll just get to this girl's house, and then I can message him. Ugh. I pushed on, imagining Weston high as hell and finding his way to God knows where. An hour later, I arrived at Beatrice's apartment building and followed the instructions she'd emailed me. She lived in a big concrete building with a call box at the front door. The neighborhood seemed quieter, more suburban, a place for families. I buzzed her, and she answered right away. "I am coming," she said, and appeared moments later. Beatrice was short, with black hair and a kind face. She wore ripped jeans and a sweater, and was probably in her mid-twenties. "Where is your other friend?" she asked me. I told her that I had lost him in the city, and that I needed to get Wi-Fi soon so that I could see if he'd tried to email me. She laughed with a worried face and hurried me up to her apartment. Two bedrooms, brown carpet, and a balcony full of plants. She said her dad lived with her, but was always traveling, so it was mostly just her. The place smelled of cigarettes and weed. I thanked her profusely for welcoming strangers into her house. "I can tell from your Instagram," she said, "that you are not crazy. I like what you write and the journey you are on. I can tell you are a nice person. I wanted to make sure you saw a good Mexico City." I checked my email, but no Weston yet. I was worried. Beatrice brought me a beer, and she lit up a cigarette, and we swapped stories. She didn't like her job and fantasized about travel. What Weston and I were doing was very inspiring to her. She had used Couchsurfer to see Europe on a budget and had traveled quite a bit. I liked her. My phone beeped, and I had a Facebook message from Weston. "I found an internet cafe. Oops, I got lost. What's the address? I only have 5 pesos, so I can only afford 10 minutes. Maybe someone will give me a bit more." When I sent him the address, he replied, "Okay, I'll ask how to get there. See you soon, smiley face." He showed up at the door 2 hours later, sun-kissed and grinning. I shouted with joy and hugged him. "You motherfucker, I thought you were dead." "I'm not the dying type," he said, through a charming smile. I was so happy to see him. But I also wanted to strangle him, to unleash a tirade against weed and his addiction to it. Beatrice made us feel at home. We'd ordered in dinner and sat on the carpet telling stories. She rolled a joint with Weston. She took pride in the way she rolled a joint, a delicate precision, and Weston was thrilled by it. "Can you show me?" he said. "Of course, I learned in Europe." She told us about the museums and the cafes and the history of Mexico City. She tried to get us to properly pronounce the volcano to the south of the city. "Popocatépetl," she said. "Pocahontas potato," I said. We laughed and laughed as they got higher and higher. With her expertise, we spent the next 2 weeks exploring Mexico City. We consumed every morsel of street food we could get our hands on. Tiny Buddha-shaped women with dark skin and aristocratic noses sat on the ground next to black round skillets frying blue corn tortillas, then serving them up with white cheese and mystery meat soaked in an earthy brown sauce. The flavors were addicting. We waited in line for more, along with men in business suits, fashionable hipster girls, a few lucky tourists, and elderly couples. Mexico City reminded me of Los Angeles in some ways, with beautiful old buildings situated next to hasty new construction and derelict buildings covered in old spray paint and new street art. The elevation makes its temperature entirely dependent on the sun. At 1 p.m., the city can feel as hot as the desert. But when the sun goes down, the temperature cools markedly. You'll be out exploring in your t-shirt during the day and end up shivering at sunset. We researched the best coffee in the city. I wanted a taste of home, some bougie hipster coffee. This was not easy to find. Yelp is so overrun with tourist reviews that it is difficult to differentiate between popular places reviewed by cheesy tourists and places that got the vibe right. We wanted third-wave coffee, the kind with pour-overs and single-origin beans and baristas in denim aprons with thick leather straps and good hair. There had to be a coffee snob or two around Mexico City somewhere, right? Deep Googling and horribly auto-translated blog articles helped us find a lead. A place called El Tercer Lugar, claiming to be craft coffee made with the precision of science and the care of an artist. We hopped in a cab and headed straight there. The cab whirled through the chaos of the Mexico City streets to bring us to the edge of the Zona Rosa, a part of town with European-looking buildings, old fancy mansions, and lush squares with mature trees and beautiful people reading on benches. Beatrice had said it was the it area with the best restaurants and hip people and speakeasies, the place where rich kids open restaurants and bars with their parents' money. We found the coffee shop on a side street with tall, thin, brownstone houses and arching, witch-fingered trees. We walked in and immediately felt at home. Exposed brick walls, antique chairs lining a communal table, fancy coffee gadgets behind the bar, all of it overseen by a barista who looked disinterested and intelligent. Absolute snobbery and perfection. We started to pathetically order in broken Spanish, but the barista mercifully interrupted. "You can just order in English if you want, but thank you for trying." "Oh, thank God," I said, laughing. "This place is amazing," Weston said. "We haven't had good coffee since San Diego." "Did you just get in today?" said the barista. "Yesterday. It's been quite the journey." "What brings you to Mexico City?" he asked. "We're bicycling to Chile." "You've got to be kidding me," the barista said with wide eyes and a wide grin. We'd gotten used to people's surprise, but hadn't heard someone speak with an American accent in a while. It was funny. "Wow, you speak English really well," I said. "Because I went to college in Oregon." "Are you from the U.S.?" "No, I'm Mexican." "Oh, you're the owner? How old are you?" 25. "But there are other investors. I'm the majority owner." "Whoa, cool," I said. He was handsome, with dark hair and small round glasses. He told us that he'd been living in Portland, which was where he'd fallen in love with coffee, and where he'd had an epiphany. "I noticed that the coffee-drinking countries weren't the coffee-producing countries," he said, "and that seemed to be a disservice to the places where the coffee comes from. I wanted the best coffee in the world to be roasted right where it grew, grown, roasted, and enjoyed right here in Mexico. So I started this place." His name was Diego, and the name of his shop, El Tercer Lugar, translated as the third place. "You know the saying, the three places. The first place is your home," Diego told us. "The second place is your work. The third place is where you go by choice, where you meet friends, hang out. We want this to be that third place." As he talked, I realized Diego was the type of person I would be friends with. I was tempted to write in real life to finish that sentence, as if this moment weren't real life. Whenever I meet someone, even in the most passing way, My brain subconsciously analyzes their speech, their diction, their humor, their demeanor, looking for signals that fit into the pre-selected categories of cool and like me. For the most part, my brain automatically discards the vast majority of people as forgettable,